This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
This is Johnny Gould's Jewish State.
You can't say, if you've had our experience, that politics doesn't matter, you know, because politics killed my grandmother, and it stole my parents' home, and it exiled my grandfather and took away his nationality, and it took away all of his books, and stole every piece of cutlery and soft furnishings that we possessed. It had a good attempt to starve everyone to death, and we've all ended up as exiles. So anybody who says politics doesn't matter, you know, we are exhibit A, it definitely does matter.
Russia, led by Stalin, and Germany by Hitler, were gruesome, murderous, evil. Yet Russia's crimes haven't been acknowledged in any comparable way to those of the Germans and their European accomplices across the continent. But it's highlighted quite rightly in this very engaging chronicle of Lord Daniel Finkelstein's own family history in his book, Hitler, Stalin, Mum and Dad, a family memoir of miraculous survival. I'm getting a taste for handing over the interview microphone. Now a previous interviewee becomes the interviewer. In episode 113, Bea Lefkovich was interviewed by Jonathan Friedland. Rather uniquely, she knew both young men who escaped Auschwitz and warned the world of the horrors within. Details so rich in our podcast that Jonathan updated his bestseller for the paperback, The Escape Artist. Here, Bayer interviews Lord Danny Finkelstein about his book, and with searching questions, a few extra nuggets appear too. Bayer also knew both Danny's parents and interviewed them too for her AJR Refugee Voices archive, where she's the director. Danny says his parents held her in high regard. And like Danny, Bayer is also the child of two Holocaust survivors. And that lived-in knowledge, that shared experience, makes Danny delve into his own family story deeper than anything you might have seen or heard about his book so far. Danny is a great storyteller. He makes the detail accessible. Not surprising, though, his career has been forged out of bringing detail to life from archives, documents, and the like.
Do I think that liberal, law-abiding democracy, the rule of law, is something that we can be certain of? No, I'm not sure I do. I think that I've come to appreciate that people are more insouciant about it than I thought, and that it's, you know, as it's gone away before, it could again. I think in this country is relatively immune from that, but it's not completely immune like anywhere in the world.
But right now, this is Bea Lefkovich, director of AJR Refugee Voices, in conversation with Lord Daniel Finkelstein, author of Hitler, Stalin, Mum and Dad, a family memoir of miraculous survival.
Oh, I'm very excited to tell their story. There was a moment when I went to the Wiener Library, which is connected to my mother's story, and I heard my father on a pair of headphones in a refugee exhibition, and I realised it was a short audio clip, so I asked the Wiener Library to send it to me, and I put it in a drawer because I just heard it, so I didn't need to hear it again. And about 6 months later, I thought it'd be nice to hear Dad's voice again, so I got the disc out of a drawer and I put it in a CD player and it wouldn't play. And it was very irritating because, you know, they'd sent it to me and it didn't play. And then I looked at it carefully and I thought, oh, it's not actually a CD. They put it on a DVD. How odd. So I put it in the DVD player and up popped my father. And it wasn't 2 minutes of audio, as I thought, but 4 hours of him talking about his story, an amazing experience. So first of all, I had that immense emotion of seeing my father, whom I love very dearly, talking, and that was an incredible experience in itself. But after that, I realised that even though we'd spoken a lot about his experiences, my parents were very open about what they'd experienced. And even though I'd actually written about both my parents, I'm a journalist, I'd written about both my parents' stories in different ways in the newspaper for articles, and for that I'd taken notes. Despite that, there was really a lot of detail that I hadn't got. And I think, had I not put that DVD in the DVD player that day, but really, had you not interviewed my father, I'm not sure that it would have been possible for me to tell my parents' story in the way that I did. So I've told the story, interlocking stories, so it goes back and forward between my mother and my father's story. Part of it, I think, is an attempt to capture the universality of the refugee and oppressive experience and the oppression that they faced. There are some things that I think are of interest to all refugees, however they've been made refugees, just the difficulty of their life. Not the life and death things, but having no money, or the fact that my grandfather is in one place and his socks somewhere else. You know, that sort of small detail of it. But obviously, the other thing it does, the commonality between the Nazi and communist oppressions, I think, does emerge very clearly. And despite the fact that we know so much about my mother's story, I don't mean the specifics of my mother's story, which are rather special, but the general story of the Holocaust, we know so much less. My mother was born in 1933 in Charlottenburg, Berlin. She was the daughter of one of the leaders of the Jewish community in Germany, Alfred Wiener, who was the syndicus or the general secretary of something called the CV, the Zentralverein, an organization that represented Jews in Germany. And as part of Alfred's work, his name was Alfred Wiener, he had begun to build an archive of material about the Nazis. Ultimately, it was going to be used in the Nuremberg trials and in the Eichmann trials, but it was a threat to the Nazis while they were active. And one of the things that happened is he had to leave Germany, go to Holland, and from Holland, eventually, because he was thought to endanger their neutrality, he came to Britain. While he was here, the Germans invaded Holland. My mother was trapped and she ended up in Belsen. But her story is one of miraculous survival. She's one of a tiny number of people who end up being exchanged because Alfred had managed to obtain for them citizenship of Paraguay. And anybody who wants to learn more about that will probably have to read the book because it's too detailed to explain now. But she met my father in London in 1956, and my father was born the only son of a very rich parent of Adolf or Dolu Finkelstein, who ran a huge company. He was known as the Iron King of Lvov. That was his nickname. When the Nazis came in from into Poland from one end, the Soviets, with a sort of ruse, came in from the other end, and the deal in the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, they took Lvov. They annexed it, creating a sort of fake election, turned it into Soviet Ukraine, then began to arrest people. My grandfather, being a city councillor, being a leading Jew, being very wealthy, was obviously on their list. He disappears one day, is taken to the Gulag, sentenced to 8 years of hard labour. And a few days later, they come arrest my, at that point, 10-year-old father and his mother. And the two of them are sent to a state collective farm on the borders, Siberian borders in Kazakhstan. But fortunately for them, but unfortunately for the rest of the family, Hitler then invaded the Soviet Union. They did a deal between the Soviets, therefore, and the British, which involved the Poles also doing a deal with the Soviets. The Soviet prisoners are released. The Polish prisoners in the Soviet Union are released. and they are ultimately, in quite unlikely circumstances, reunited. They join something called the Anders Army, go through the Soviet Union to Iran, from Iran to Palestine, and eventually with the Polish Resettlement Corps, they came here. My parents eventually met each other, bought a house in Hendon, and never left. And when my mother died, she did it in her bed, as she would have wished to, in Hendon Central. And that is their story, very rapidly done. But if anyone's Hitler, Stalin, mum and dad, has a longer account.
The interviews, I remember them very, very vividly, both of them. Your father more reluctant to speak. I think it was first we interviewed your mother, but then he...
So interestingly, my parents were very open with me about the whole thing. They always would answer questions and they would sometimes talk about it unprompted. Mostly it was prompted because they didn't want to bore anyone. I think there was a hilarious reason. But interestingly, I don't think my father told me that he'd done that interview. I was aware of you because he spoke of you in glowing terms quite often. But I wasn't aware of the origin of that and I didn't know that he'd done it. Now it may be... I was so busy living my life, I didn't listen when he told me he'd done it, but I don't think he did tell me. And obviously it was a tremendous pleasure and privilege to discover he'd done it.
And it wasn't, I mean, even I remember, it's an unusual story, and people don't know about it, about the hardship of the Gulag and how they survived. So that's all in your book.
Do you know, it is, but you say it's an unusual story. It happened to hundreds of thousands of people. And actually, the way that I put it about the book, my mother's is a highly unusual version of a standard Holocaust story. But it's a highly unusual story.
Yes.
But everyone knows that story. But they don't know the highly unusual version of my mother's, you know, how it happened that she came to be free and all those things. My father's story, it happened to lots and lots of people. People just don't know it. I think what was good, and you said this to me, my father had an immense recall of detail. I used to joke about how my grandmother would introduce herself to the driver of the bus to Golders Green, but my father would then remember the name for 30 years. He had an extraordinary recollection. And I recall this in the book when we did a quiz once where the question was, what is the inscription? No, it wasn't. It was, what year was Admiralty Arch built? My brother knew the year off the top of his head. I hadn't got a clue, by the way. My father confirmed that it was true by reciting the whole of the inscription in Latin, translating it, and then telling me that my brother was correct. He wasn't new to show off either. That's what he was like. He could remember. He had an amazing recollection.
That brings me to my next question about memory. You start the beginning of your book with a quote from your grandfather, Dr. Alfred Wiener, which says, I'm prepared to forget as long as everyone else remembers. So I want to know, why did you choose to remember now?
So there are some contingent reasons. I sat still long enough because of COVID to actually get going and produce reach critical mass. For a long time, and then another contingent reason, somebody approached me and asked to be my agent. And I felt embarrassed that I hadn't got anything to. I'd helped with David Cameron in a book, and also with a football player who wanted to do a book, and my agent had negotiated those, and then those projects had come to fruition, and now I needed, now he was waiting for something else. So I felt it was something that I sort of had to do because it was embarrassing. But of course, there were bigger reasons. I felt that whereas 15 years ago, it would be impossible to imagine the things that happened to my parents happening to my children, I don't think I could be so confident about that now. I don't think it will. But do I think that liberal, law-abiding democracy, the rule of law, is something that we can be certain of? No, I'm not sure I do. I think that I've come to appreciate that people are more insouciant about it than I thought. And that it's, as it's gone away before, it could again. I think in this country is relatively immune from that, but it's not completely immune like anywhere in the world. You know, if you look at the United States, probably the most important force for democratization in the 20th century, it's in quite a lot of trouble. Yeah. And you've got to look at that and think, well, okay, I think this story does need to be told now. So there was a political impetus to it, definitely.
So is there a political message then in that case?
Well, yeah. So at the end of the book, I said that my parents had two different experiences, and my father was not really asked to recall his, except by you, very often. But they processed their experiences in the same way, in that they processed it in a personal way. The personal way was they were determined not to be victims and not to see themselves as victims. They realised that they were, in an objective sense. They didn't object to other people doing so, but for them, you know, they weren't denying other people's victimhoods, but for them, they felt it, the liberating thing was to move on. And my mother was very keen that survivor not be her identity. She was a survivor and she was willing to acknowledge it and work with other survivors. She did a lot of Holocaust education, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't the primary thing. And she certainly never wanted me to see myself a second generation survivor, right? I think she would regard that as a failure if I saw myself in quite that way. So I think that was the, and they both saw it in that way, definitely saw it in that way. But they also had a political thing. So first of all of their children are very engaged in public life. My sister's a permanent secretary in the civil service. My brother's been chief scientific advisor for national security. He's the president of a university, and I've been involved in politics and journalism, tried to be a public voice for the things that I believe in. And that's because you can't say, if you've had our experience, that politics doesn't matter, you know, because politics killed my grandmother and it stole my parents' home and it exiled my grandfather and took away his nationality and it took away all of his books and stole every piece of cutlery and soft furnishings that we possessed. It had a good attempt to starve everyone to death and we've all ended up as exiles. So anybody who says politics doesn't matter, you know, we are exhibit A, it definitely does matter. You know, I always remember being in school struggling with the argument, why am I more interested in politics than the other kids? And now I kind of realise why that was. And I would feel much more able to justify that. So there was that. But there's also a particular type of politics. So we're for the rule of law, for moderation and proportion. We accord an important place to human rights, which my grandfather, by the way, wasn't. We're supporters of a state of Israel for Jews. We believe in a multicultural society, but we're very attached to our national identity. All those things are definitely part from my parents' experiences. Bits that are directly from my father's teaching or my mother's teaching, and other things are things I've gleaned from understanding their story.
So, well, I find it interesting, the idea about being a public figure in politics. For my parents, I'm, you know, second generation parent survivors, there was, the message was very much, stay out of, do not be a public person, you know, it's too dangerous, you know, so it's okay. Interesting because you can take the opposite message.
Yes.
Politics is dangerous. Do not, you know, keep a low profile. Do not speak up.
The truth of it is that both my parents, to be fair to them, were involved in, both my grandparents on both sides, the grandfathers were involved in politics, but, you know, politics came to them. They didn't go looking for it, you know, so I wish it was a protection that people weren't involved in politics. But, you know, my mother's aunt, she wasn't involved in politics at all, and she died in Sobibor, you know. So I kind of get that idea. But I sort of object to the idea that I might be put off from being in public life. But secondly, it wasn't... So what's an interesting thing about my mother's story is that in 1940, when Holland is invaded, they'd had this library in Holland. Most of it had moved, but Greta, my grandmother, was worried that people would know who Alfred Wiener was and they would come for him. So they unscrewed the nameplate and they burnt a lot of documents when it first happened. But what then happens is that the Nazis don't come for him. And actually, they just get arrested like everyone else in the end. And so it wasn't because Alfred was involved in politics. It wasn't because he'd gone round the country trying to warn people against Hitler. It wasn't because he had this archive. It was just because he was Jewish, or that they were.
Yeah, the other thing you said now and you write in the book is about your parents not being defined by being survivors. And I think that's really interesting. Again, it brings me to the second generation. You see, you said your mother didn't like the idea of second generation, but you, first of all, would you consider yourself second generation? Do you think it's a useful category for a number of people at all?
I never use that term. But the other thing, I'm sure my mum would agree with me, is I never argue about how what people would like to call themselves or how they'd like to regard themselves.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
I don't want to quibble with other people. It's not some sort of competition. If people feel that, then I'm very happy to accept them on their own terms. It's just not how I think of myself. I'm sure that my mother didn't think other people shouldn't think of themselves as second generation. She wasn't dismissive of anybody. That's what her character was. And I'm not either. It's just not how I think of myself. I definitely have been, and it's obvious to me, I'm profoundly influenced by what happened to my parents. My politics makes no sense whatsoever without an understanding that. And one of the reasons I wanted to write the book was for that reason. It explains an awful lot. But two things. One is clearly the fact that I'm the child of two refugees, and they have that experience and came to this country, unquestionably influences my politics, and I frequently reference it. So if you want to call it second generation, you can. But that's the second point, which is I'm so super cool with other people using it. You know, they're my lovely friends and I embrace them in our common experience, and I'd be the last person to say don't call yourself this or you shouldn't be that, or you know, it's like people have this ludicrous thing as who is a Holocaust survivor, yeah. Right? And I haven't got any. My no mum didn't have any time for that, and I've got no time for it either, right?
But culturally moved, you know, which is really interesting because post war. Survivor was really reserved for concentration camp survivors.
Yeah.
And you can feel that has moved and moved and
Mum
moved.
Mum had this great phrase, which she always used, which is not a competition, right? Because she actually used to always say that, you know, my father had been on a train for longer than her, right? Because she'd been on this horrible train to between Vesterborg and Belsen, which was objectively terrible. It was so hot and they were all in these many layers of clothing to keep the clothing. So it was insufferable, actually. And my father had been on a horrendous journey, which had taken 3 weeks. And every time my mother told the story about her own experience, which had taken some hours, she would always say Ludwig's was worse, right? And that is very typical of her as a personality, and I kind of share it, but it's more a description of her personality than it is of the experience.
There's another term, I don't know whether you've come across, it's called post-memory. And there's a scholar, which is kind of interesting in America, she's called Marianne Hurd, and she came up with this idea of the post-memory of the second and third generation. So, and it, what it means is that you have a relationship to that history. I kind of like that term.
Of course, we've all got it.
So we're all positions you somewhere.
Yeah, we're all the subject of our DNA and our genes and our histories. And Mum didn't like about it for us. Right? Not in general. She just felt she wanted us to live as normal a life, forward-facing, into the country we were born in, one with the modern world. She didn't want her own experiences to be visited on me. She didn't want us to wallow in the misery of her, you know, of her own oppression. That's not what she survived for, right? That's her view.
Many people felt like that, but nevertheless, now, you know, we have lots of second, third generation who feel all kinds of things, and some of them now with the whole citizenship, of course, right. Which is a different
situation. I completely, you know? I have no argument whatsoever with how anyone else wants to feel. I can only speak for myself, and I don't do that in a spirit ever of criticism of other people's experiences, because everybody had terrible experiences and we're all brothers and sisters in arms, you know. Yeah. That's what I think.
I guess some people, second, third generation, there's a lot, I think, in England about not speaking on silence, and that wasn't your experience, wasn't my experience either.
No.
And I think that helps a lot.
It was a lot. So I do understand that, and I think that did help an awful lot. And one of the reasons I've told my parents' story is because I could. And I on my father's story, I had a lot of help with. So my in a suitcase in my parents' office when they died, I found a bag full of indecipherable letters. They were Polish, I worked, right? And there were 90 of them. And I then found that there was some people in America who were friends of some relations of mine who lived there, who they had lost relatives in the Polish deportation. And they felt very moved by it. And I was helping to tell their story by telling mine. So they were willing to help with it. They were willing to help me with the translation. And that was invaluable, like, because I couldn't even read them. Because the thing about the German is that you can read it, then you can put it into, you know, you can use Google Translate to at least find out what it is. Then you can get a translator after that. With the Polish, you couldn't even read it. And I told this story partly because my parents did talk to me and I did know what happened. And so the book is written for my parents, and for all the readers who don't know anything about it and had nothing to do with it, but also for everybody who had a similar experience. Oh, and for one other group of people as well, people in this country who had the trauma of their relatives liberating Belsen, of which there are an amazing number who often write to me. And for them, I hope they'll discover what Belsen was and why what happened to it, happened to people there, happened.
In my own extended family is a remarkable man in his late 90s, Stanley Fisher, a British Jewish soldier among the first to witness the liberation of Bergen-Belsen. Stanley landed on Normandy's beaches in the week of D-Day and fought in the bloody Battle of Arnhem, a costly setback for the Allies.
When we heard about Belsen, we thought it was like a prisoner of war camp. When I saw, or what I saw, was horrific. I saw walking skeletons, because at that time that I got there, which was the end of April, beginning of May, and they were beginning to move the inmates out. And I had nightmares for years after that.
Stanley's story is episode 16.
So speaking of trauma, which is interesting, so I find the tone of your book, the tone is not that of trauma and dislocation, but of change, you know, of a new life started.
Look, it's written in the spirit of my parents, not because I did it that deliberately, but because they're my parents and I. So what's so fascinating, I mean, there are lots of things, is that you find out a lot of the time how many attitudes. I have no doubt my grandfather got himself into many political arguments, and I read about them, and I have no doubt in each occasion that I would have taken his side in those particular disputes, even when he wasn't right. I would have made the same mistakes. And then I found my grandmother's PhD, and her topic was basically a critique of over-ideological free marketeers from a free market perspective. That is such a niche political position, and it happens also to be mine. I mean, my father did feel very deeply about it. Both my parents did. My father, I think I might even say even more, maybe. But and it was objectively, you can see that it was quite traumatic when you read about it. And in my mother's case, I definitely had the more that I. I found some newspaper cuttings of people who'd seen what must have been my mother, as well as a small group of, 100 other people coming off a train just after she was released from the camp. And when you read it, you realised how close to death they all were. And that was pretty shocking to me, because of the way that my mother always talked about it was never like that. I mean, she never dramatised, she under-dramatised what happened to her.
So you, in a way, took on her narrative.
But it's definitely influenced the way that I've seen it. But I mean, when you read her story, you realise it was every bit as terrible as you would imagine it was. But it's just that she was so incredibly sort of philosophical about it, and also so determined that we wouldn't be thrown by it. She felt that it was the final. It would be her victory over what had happened to her was not. She was not going to let it spoil her life, and she was not going to let it spoil my life. Right? Yeah, that was absolutely what she was going to do. She wasn't going to, it happened when she was young and she'd come to this country. She'd married my dad. They were very, very, very happy together. They had a lovely life. And she was determined that that was how she was going to think of herself.
But do you think sometimes a way of doing it is actually not to talk too much in detail? You see,
I see what you mean.
Because I find, I tell you from my school, my parents, my mother spoke a lot. But now, thinking what I found, photographs, letters, and I find my knowledge was actually not that detailed, because the detail is quite terrible, but the, you know, if you kind of talk about in bigger things, you can create that sort of narrative.
I'm sure that's true. I think there was probably also an element that she told me a lot of these stories when I was quite young, and then she also spoke to a lot of schools where she was definitely trying to tell them a story which they could understand but without horrifying them too much, and there's no doubt about it. When I was actually, fun enough, reading this last night, when Investorborg, as you'll be aware, every Tuesday there were these transports, and so on Monday night they would read the list out in each of the barracks as to people who were going to be deported to the East, and they both did and didn't know what was going to happen. I mean, they really did, but they also denied it to themselves and all that. But it was horrendous, this, and I then realised this must have gone on every week for seven months, right? So that is a horrendous thing, and my mother didn't talk about that.
This is what I mean. It's because I find when you really think about those details, they are terrible, and there's no way around it. But
yes,
maybe, you know.
So there was lots of reasons. Yeah. There may be lots of reasons for that, why she didn't go into those details. But I definitely think one of them was she didn't want that to dominate her life. I think that was very important.
So just tell us a little bit about your childhood in Hendon.
Yeah, so we just... you know, my parents lived in Hendon all their life, really, and we lived a standard childhood in this country. My grandmother got some recompense, interestingly enough, from the Germans.
Your Polish Jewish grandmother.
Even though they'd actually been victims of the communists, but they got restitution, and with that restitution, my parents bought a house, and my grandmother paid for half of our education. So we went to a private, even though my mum was a teacher and my dad was an academic, certainly nowadays it'd be very hard for them to afford to do that. But the restitution money helped to do that. It was a very bookish household, again, very much like my grandparents, but it was Jewish. So some people, I think, were pushed away from religion by the experiences they'd had. My mother was never pushed away from it. My mother never was believed in a supernatural God before or afterwards or at any point. So she, her view was God didn't let that happen. People made it happen. So it didn't reduce her. It didn't affect her faith in it. But my father felt the same, but he was incredibly intellectually interested in Judaism. In a funny way, that hadn't been the case all of his life, but he met my grandfather, my mother's father, Alfred Wiener. And my mother's father was incredibly interested in that. His hobby really was reading about Judaism, and that became my father's hobby as well.
And I think your father did a degree.
My father then did a PhD.
In his retirement.
Yes, his hobby was the progressive rabbinate of 19th century Warsaw. Mine was football, you know. They were slightly disparate, different things.
So you're assimilated.
Yeah, so that's an interesting thing. So that's a very interesting point, by the way. I'm sure that part of the reason that my dad had absolutely no interest in films, pop music, pop football or popular culture, was not just because he was a refugee, but because he had no teenage years at all. I'm sure part of it was just who he was, right? So, you know, there are lots of people in this country who had perfectly good teenagers, but aren't in those things either. But they definitely were part of the reason. So I definitely got interests that, of course, relate to living here, which would have been incomprehensible to my grandfather or my father.
What were the remnants there of the continental, apart from the books?
Cuisine, obviously. I remember we had something in the hall.
Yeah.
It was a telephone directory, which you moved the little thing and then it popped up like that, and we called it the clupper, right? The telephone clupper. And I remember once saying this to a school friend who didn't know what I was talking about. And I slowly realised it was, maybe it wasn't German. I don't know what language it was or where it came from. My parents both spoke a lot of languages. And they had so there were certain continental phrases we'd use that other people wouldn't. And obviously we had continental food, which I didn't appreciate was continental.
Like?
Goulash, for example, or I'm trying to think of other things that my mother made that were, pierogi was dumplings that my grandmother made, or schnitzels. Another thing, this is pretty interesting. So my mother made something she called risotto, right? Well, what this actually was fried rice with whatever was chicken usually. And I absolutely loved it. Right? So to the point where when I actually one day was served a risotto, I found it very disappointing, right? Actual risotto, I'm not that fond of. My mother's risotto, I really loved because I like fried rice, basically. And when I was researching the book, I came across a piece of paper which was obviously in my grandmother's, my mother's mother's handwriting. And I was trying to translate it. And eventually I thought, that word is definitely omelette. So then I sent it to somebody to translate it for me. And it turned out that my grandmother had written down in Belsen lots of recipes. And I'm sure that the reason for that was not to retain some family folklore, because it wouldn't make sense for that to be the reason. What it was that people were talking about food. I know this from a lot of my research into Belsen in general. People talked about food the whole time. And what she was doing was writing down the food to remember it. Anyway, when I said to the translator, she said, one thing I'm a bit confused about is the use of this risotto that's in this list, because people didn't have risotto at that time, right? Anyway, I looked at the risotto recipe and it was fried rice, right? So that is where my mother got it. And somehow they got this term that used it and she called it risotto. So there you go, that's a link with that.
But there's all the children who basically believe what their parents tell them and have no idea. Completely. Same thing about the accent you mentioned in the book. You didn't know that your mother
had accent. Well, my sister had that experience where someone said to her, where does your mum come from? And, as far as she was concerned, it was like, well, Cheney Walk Hendon, obviously. It was only as we got older that we sort of began to realise they didn't come from there, in quotation marks.
You didn't feel that? Did you feel any loss or absence or kinds of...
No, I didn't. My parents worked very hard. They didn't want us to feel like the last remnants of a dying continental culture. I think my grandfather, my mother's father, definitely did feel that, but he was much older, obviously. But my father and my mum were determined not to feel that, but definitely in their whole interests and outlook, that definitely was part of it.
What about their friends, for example?
Yeah, so all their friends, almost all their friends were, in fact, refugees.
Yeah.
I didn't, lots of them would change names and stuff. I didn't know. I just discovered it afterwards. They had very few of, I suppose, conventional friends that you would meet sort of ordinarily. I do remember a friend who was a Scottish Labour MP who'd become a Lord. My parents thought that was great that he was a Lord. And he came around to dinner, I remember, Lord Howie of Troon. And I met him. I was then in the House of Lords with him, which was quite nice. He was very old. He's no longer alive now. And I remember that mainly because it was so odd that they had a friend who came around who was like not... who was British and by birth and not Jewish. And... it was one of those dinner parties that I met my in-laws.
Okay.
And I married their daughter.
Okay. Yeah. So, because I think, again, other people find themselves in a situation where they don't quite realise that all the friends, or that they themselves are second, third generation. Yeah. They didn't actually know that at school.
My father, my father was very open and professionally, he had lots of, he worked in the mining research establishment. He went down the mines. He was a university academic. He had lots of friends professional friends who were born in Britain and who, that was their background, but went for socialising.
You're in an unusual situation, and so far that your grandfather really founded an institute, to chronicle history, to fight against anti-Semitism. Where do you see your legacy? Let's talk about Holocaust education in general. How do you feel you should continue that?
Okay, so that's interesting. So when my mother became, so this is another impetus for the book, where my mother became, my mother had began to do schools, a particularly moving thing where she went, George Osborne invited her to number 10 Downing Street to talk to his kids because he wanted them to meet a Holocaust survivor, and it was, you know, it made an impression on them, and George absolutely loved it, and my mother obviously loved going to number 10 to do that. But even I'm 60, and so obviously we're going to have to make sure that we pass that on. So my son was very involved in the book. My oldest son was very involved in the production of this book, and actually my middle son also helped me with some of the scanning of the documents. I've tried to involve them all in it a bit.
Do you feel they'll take this on?
Yeah, so I'm sure they will. My son, particularly my oldest son, is really very interested in it. He's interested in Judaism and he's interested in the history, and they definitely all feel it's something that they have to do.
And what do you think? So we have collected all these testimonies, like your parents in the world, probably, I'm sure the Shaw Foundation, 52,000, other archives, maybe we have, I don't know, nobody's counted all the testimonies. What do you think should happen? They are, you know, they're sitting in archives and libraries worldwide.
Well, some of them will sit there and people won't review them, but they'll also be there when people need to have them. I mean, I'm sure that when I reviewed the minutes of the meeting between Jim Callaghan and my father, Jim Callaghan, the former British Prime Minister, and my grandfather, I was probably the first person to look at that document in years, you know. But so it's in an archive, and people don't necessarily use it, but then sometimes they do. And then, you know, my career really has been about popularizing information which I read, so you don't have to, you know, you the reader don't have to. And this is what I've tried to do with this. So I've tried to collect, I hope that people who read what I've written will then get a much sort of more coherent idea of what happened in the Second World War and how the Holocaust happened. Okay, so the thing that is very important to understand is, I have to put this in a tactful way, people are not immensely well informed about lots of things. Right. And one should be contain one's expectation about how knowledgeable people are about lots of things. And that's not to patronise people. I remember hearing on the radio a plumber, and he'd come on the radio, he did a quiz, and the question he was asked was, who was the dictator of Italy while Hitler was the dictator of Germany? And he got as far as saying it was Mr. something or other. That's what he said.
Yeah.
And he didn't know who Mussolini was. And so then he was told it was Mussolini. And his response was, well, you probably don't know where the stopcock is. And he's probably right. Okay. So I certainly couldn't give you a coherent description of how my central heating works. Everyone has their own knowledge. Right? You can't expect everybody to have an incredible knowledge of the Holocaust, however much you teach it. It's just too much to expect. But what we should try to do is to make sure that well-informed people integrate that into their thinking, and that the information is available to anyone who wants to learn, and that some very basic ideas, Hitler was bad and killed a lot of Jews. I know that sounds, but that is important. If I can get that across to people. And by the way, one of the things in my book, Stalin was also very bad and also killed a lot of people. And it's just important people get a grip of that. And I don't expect most people to end up knowing what Katyn was.
But do you think it will help, you know, with contemporary anti-Semitism? Because obviously that's now a topic which maybe wasn't a topic 20 years ago.
Of course, it was.
You know?
Yes, I think it does help. And it does, we've got a growth of anti-Semitism, but we've also got a growth in the world of kind of understanding about racism. Those things are in tension. But sadly, I don't think we will ever eliminate prejudice or oppression or people killing each other because one person has a rabbit god and the other person has got an elephant god, right? People just do that. And I don't think we'll ever eliminate that, but we can contribute to it, and all you can do is contribute a little bit to it. And so I understand sort of feeling of despair, but I think you'd give up altogether if you expect too much. And I just want to get across the idea is it's very dangerous if we go down the route of dictatorships because all these people got killed, right? And that would then... it's better if I can have people better informed than that. We should try. Yeah. But if we can get that across to start off with, it would be good.
Okay. Well, hopefully you'll achieve that. But it's what also is interesting, it seems there's more interest. There is maybe more in Samson, but there's also more interest in Holocaust. I don't know whether you find that.
Yeah,
you know,
completely.
There's so many books.
My mother said to me, there was a number of things. First of all, one of the things that I wondered about with my book was, would the publishers all say, thank you very much for the idea, but do you have any other ideas? Because people have written all about this. And indeed, one of my friends actually, years ago, his agent said to him, he's a broadcaster, don't write about that. And everyone's writing about that. But that was totally not my experience. The publishers were absolutely falling over themselves to publish it. Quite seriously, it was very interesting. And they know what they're doing. So obviously they think, people have got an interest in this and they will want to buy it. And that's very encouraging. People do have an interest in it. So obviously, by the way, we can achieve much more than rudimentary knowledge for educating people who read books. And that's obviously ought to be an objective, because teaching, you know, intelligent, literate people some of the details of how and what happened is very important. You know, my view is anyone who wants to understand what's happening in Israel, for example, and who wants a view on the Middle East, probably first ought to understand what happened to, you know, the arguments my grandfather engaged in the 1920s, where he thought it wouldn't, you know, he wrote best-selling books saying he didn't think that creating a state in Israel would be necessary, and events rather changed his mind. So obviously, you know, that kind of literacy is pretty important for politically engaged, literate people. But I think we're doing not badly with those people. I think that's, you know, where I worry about more is a kind of general lack of sort of lack of understanding of the importance of the rule of law, really.
Which is a slightly different topic, but part of
part the rule of law, I would say, is about the maintenance of a system that guarantees people's individual liberty as well as a democratic state.
You know, for example, not only the publication of the books, but also Holocaust Memorial Day. To me, it seems getting bigger and bigger. I'm just talking now UK, also worldwide, but it seems there are more institutions, more...
I used to joke to my mother that it was her busy season. It's no question about it.
It just is interesting. Have you got any tips for any other second, third generation who want to write about their families now, based on your own research and your engagement?
So obviously, if you still can, please make sure that you try and record your parents in some form, preferably video. It's the best form. But if you can do it, if you can't, then do it writing it down. But okay, that's maybe too late for some people. The second thing I would say, which is very important, is that what happened to your parents happened to other people, and they have written about it. So if you know that your parents lived in a particular town, well, there are lots of other people who lived in that town, and you can find out all about that town, and what happened to them will have happened to other people. So for example, in one of the characters in my book, he is shot in the Katyn massacre, which is explained in the book. But when people read it, they think to yourself, well, because he got shot, you think, how does anyone know? How do you know that's what happened to him? Because he was shot. And the answer is because it happened to several thousand people, and it all happened in the same way because someone wrote about that. Someone who did it wrote about it. So therefore, there's a record of it. So exactly what happened to each person, not individually, but as a group, is described. If you I discovered what texture the carriages that took my mother from Belsen to Switzerland, that it was soft furnishing because somebody put it in their book. My mother didn't say it, but somebody else who was on the same train said it. So I suppose my biggest thing is, you've not lost the information if you haven't done the interview. What you need to do is think of the things that you know, and remember that if you're parents lived in a certain town, or they went to a certain concentration camp, or then what happened to other people when them were the same. And you can find a surprising amount of their story out of that. It's all in archives, in other people's books. You can piece it all together.
And also it creates a sense, interesting enough, sense of community. I mean, you have people that say the descendants of Kitchener camp, you know, where the,
yeah.
I'm thinking where people were in the same
It's an extraordinary,
camp, you know, and there is a sort of legacy going on.
Yeah, we've got a friend, and she had a great aunt, I think, that had been in concentration camp, and that was a person that they thought of in their community. And we worked out that at different points she must have been in the same barrack as my mum. And so therefore, you know, this was somebody that I knew here. Actually, Philippe Sands,
yeah.
I went to school, who wrote East West Street, I went to school with Philippe. We weren't in the same class, we were in different years. And Philippe, and we were cordial, but we were not particularly friends. We are now, we weren't not at the time. And in his book, East West Street, he talks about the Landis family of Leveuf. Well, so do I in my book. It turns out we actually have the same, some common family. We think we're third cousins. We've kind of embraced that. We're not 100% certain, but we've decided we are certain enough. And so we refer to each other as cousin and regard ourselves as relatives.
Okay, learned something new, interesting. Okay, almost lastly, do you feel the war in Ukraine and these current discussions about British immigration policy kind of resonate, especially?
Yes. You? So I don't. Let's take them. They're separate things.
Yeah. They're.
So the war in Ukraine, obviously, you know, bombs are literally falling on Lviv. You know, in the place where I visited to see my father's house with Philippe. One of the reasons that is can happen is because of a concerted attempt by the Russians. The Russians didn't lose the war, unlike the Nazis. They were not forced to confront what happened to them. They all the things that the Nuremberg defendants were found guilty of, the Russians, the Soviets did all of them. Right, the Soviets were guilty of all of the crimes. They even tried to convict the Nuremberg defendants of the Katyn massacre, which they themselves had committed. Because the Soviets never had to have a reckoning, because they won rather than lost the war, they can continue to distort and their history of the area and continue to behave in an oppressive way to that area, continue to pretend the things that did not happen, that happened did not happen. And I think there's an obvious resonance of my book with what's happening in there in a direct way. It's to the same places. And anybody who wants to understand how certain parts of Ukraine became part of Ukraine can read the book and find that out. British immigration policy is a more subtle thing. So my grandfather spent a lot of the war in New York. But one of the British decide at the end of the war, they're not going to continue to fund his library, right? An incredibly short-sighted and stupid decision, but understandable when you take it in the context of all the other things they had going on, right? Now it seems like, how could you not think that was a valuable resource? They hadn't even had the Nuremberg trials yet, and they were already saying, we're not going to finance your archive of Nazi material, even though it then proved incredibly valuable, and there'd been no historical research on it. So it's like, seems bonkers. But then you think to yourself, well, actually, there were millions of displaced people in the world. The whole world had been sort of burnt to the ground. So naturally, you know, so you reach a bit more of an understanding of what happened. But my grandfather had gone to America. He came back to this country, and because they weren't going to give him any money, they said you can have your period in the United States recognised as a period in Britain, and you're therefore eligible for citizenship. And that's how he became a citizen of this country. But at that point, they were not. There was a relatively limited number of people coming, and it was also part of a massive worldwide refugee problem, which had been caused by, you know, literal genocide in particular places. So both scale and immediacy were a bit different.
Yeah.
There's no question that their experience leads you to look at every person who wants to come through the lens of, are we denying somebody in immediate human need who wants to come here. But it also, but I look at every person thinking, I don't, however, have a duty to be in favour of all and every person who wants to immigrate to this country, because we cannot, because the scale is just simply different and the immediacy is different in lots of cases, not in all, but in lots of cases. And where the immediacy is not different, i.e. Ukraine, this country has actually responded. So I would say that my position on this is like a lot of things is sort of moderate. I think that people who have our experience and are therefore very open to the idea that we need to, this country needs to have safe and legal asylum and it needs to protect asylum, and we've got a certain responsibility because of our background, I guess, to observe how important that was in the past. But I don't feel it, but I sometimes feel that people have got no responses to, well, what do we do about the fact that there are many too many people who'd want to avail themselves of that, which there were not before, which we can't actually cope with. And at what point is that? It's quite tricky, right? Because you're then trading off people's immediate needs or even their legitimate desires with this country's own stability, right? And I've never felt it was reasonable to just ignore this country's own stability, because one of the things, this country was kind enough for me to take in my parents, and I don't want to say by that, because you took in my parents, I'm going to insist you take in everybody, right? That's sort of an odd position also. So it's just a very difficult issue. One of the things that we have got to accept in the world is there are too many refugees for every country that wants to take refugees to take them. But here's another point. People don't want to be refugees. So the thing that's informed me most is I very strongly believe in international aid. I very strongly support the international refugee effort. I very strongly support military intervention where necessary to protect democracies against illiberal forces and to prevent people becoming refugees in the first place, or to protect people who are refugees. That, in my view, is the first line. My grandfather didn't want to live in this country. He wanted to live in Germany. He was German. When he died, he has his funeral in German. He said my funeral should be in German and Hebrew. On his coffin, a wreath from the Federal Republic. And the ambassador was there. And the president issued a statement about my grandfather. He regarded, even though he was a naturalized Briton, he still had a strong association with Germany. He didn't want to be here, live here, be driven out. And what he wanted to do was to resist the Nazis in Germany. Yeah. That's what he was trying to do. And so I guess my attitude to it is one step before. There's very little I wouldn't do to prevent people from becoming refugees. That's how I relate my experience to the refugees. Well, I would definitely call myself a British Jew. I always say that I'm the son of Holocaust survivor and son of a refugee from the Soviet Union. But I regard myself primarily as a kind of, you know, British journalist, living in Pinner with my family, you know, and that's how my parents would want me to think of myself.
And do you have any message for anyone who might watch this interview in the future?
There are a few things, like everyone should try and be kind to each other. My mother always used to say, we all have our own meshugas, which for those people who don't know what that means, we all have our own craziness. We all have our own eccentricities. We should tolerate those in other people. We should try to defend the vulnerable. Because not everybody will be kind, even though we think people should be kind, and defend the rule of law, and also get things in proportion. That's my mother's most important message. So she would never have a row with somebody about a synagogue council. She'd never resign from the synagogue council or have a row with a neighbour about a tree. It was never important enough to her. So for some people, I suppose they saw Hitler and Stalin in everything, whereas my mother's approach was to see them in nothing, right? She's nothing was like that. And therefore we can get all of it in proportion. Since proportion is required in most things, I think if people could manage it a bit more, it would be, it'd be a good thing. It's subjective, of course, but it's still a good guide.
And that's what I remember. That's what she said. And she lived like that. She said she's not going to.
She did.
She wasn't bothered by.
She was never ever petty. So we once, years later, she was the victim of some effectively theft from her, and this kind of manifested itself because one of the people working said to my sister that she'd not left enough food for the people who were working for her. And my sister was, no, that definitely didn't happen. That's how we discovered that there was some theft going on, because that was impossible. My mother was never, ever petty about things. And that was her takeaway from it. My father as well, you know, which is be big-hearted, try and be big about things, try and be generous. Nothing's like Hitler and Stalin. It's not a competition. Allow people to live their lives, see things in proportion, be moderate in everything, try and be kind to each other, try and keep the law, you know, which my father was always very keen on, because he thought once we'd decided that we didn't have to keep them, why should anyone else? My parents, I can try. I only wish sometimes that I was, you know, as capable of being equitable as my mum was.
The best guests and their most heartfelt views, a relay of their missions to a worldwide audience. Hi, it's Johnny again, just popping in at the end of this one. 100 episodes along, and I'm proud that it's fast become the podcast of record. This is coverage of the Jewish and Israeli world that just doesn't get properly aired in mass media, and I'm not ashamed to ask for your help. A one-off donation is always gratefully received to support my efforts, but a monthly donation really gets our service off the ground. Your donation can also be made with gift aid, and it's so easy to do. Just click on this, donorbox.org/JG podcast. That's donorbox.org/JG podcast. Are you in? Please share my series with your friends, and thank you for listening. And so very often themes develop and tie episodes together in Johnny Gould's Jewish State, because I ran a competition at my children's school to win the chance of making an episode of my podcast. 11-year-old Bella Bolo was the winner, and like Danny, she's developed an early interest in news and politics. And so Bella will join me to interview Bill Browder, CEO and co-founder of Hermitage Capital Management, at one time the largest foreign portfolio investor in Russia. His lawyer, Sergei Matnitsky, was tortured and killed as he became a target for Putin's brutal regime. It's another future episode not to miss.
Johnny Gould's Jewish State is brought to you with Dangor Education.